Jesse, you must listen to WUOY 90.9 FM on the net. Don't touch that dial. Jesse, keep it locked.
The YMCA is just a starting line. For the true self blooms only when we find our purpose, what makes us tick below the surface. Y is the before work hustle, an after school home, a section of my block, a corner to call my own. With my Y, I stand strong. Seen and supported all along. It's a million faces in a mirror, and everyone belongs. Find your why. Join today at ymca.org for a better us.
Hey everyone, you're listening to the WONY Weekly Update. Here's some upcoming events to look forward to. On Monday, April 27th, the SUNY Oneonta Chamber Orchestra has a performance at the Fine Arts Center in room M201 at 7:30 p.m. Also on Monday, the Activities Council is hosting a karaoke night happening in the Hunt Union Waterfront Room at 9 p.m. On Tuesday, April 28th, men's baseball plays SUNY Poly happening at 4 p.m. at the Red Dragon Baseball Field. And as usual, Trivia Tuesday will be happening in the Red Dragon Theater at 9 p.m. On Wednesday, April 29th, the Office of Student Experience is hosting their XOXO Red Dragons event, where you could drop by and take a moment to write a letter home to your family, friends, or supporters. This event will be happening from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. in the Hunt Union Lobby. On Thursday, April 30th, the annual Juried Student Show will have its reception in the Martin Muller Gallery in Fine Arts. Check out over 90 pieces of work by over 70 students highlighting different themes and mediums from over the academic year. The reception will be from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m., but the gallery will be open until May 2nd. Also on Thursday, the Gender and Sexuality Resource Center will be hosting a Paint and Sip with Pride event happening from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. in the Leather Stocking Room in Hunt Union. Spots are limited, so RSVP to the event to guarantee your spot. This has been your WONY Weekly Update on WONY 90.9 FM Oneonta. More information about these events and more can be found on Campus Connection. Have a great week, everybody. Keep it locked.
Yo, 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 everyone. What's going on? It's DJ Nos from R2 Rocket and What's in Your Pocket this morning. Yesterday, when I was on with Heavy Metal Mondays with Todd Evans, I had noticed that there was a little bit of, it almost sounds like a delay or a little bit of chorus on my voice. And it's there today, too. So I don't really know what that is. If you're out there in Radioland and you can hear it, it doesn't sound bad. It just sounds a little bit more eccentric, I would say. Anyways, this is episode 112 today, and we're here with the infamous Dr. Adam Kent. Are you there? Can we hear you, your voice?
You're right.
That's right. He's here. We're going to get into his whole shtick and spiel and things he does with his life, and he's an amazing person, in a second. What I want to do today is just talk about a couple things happening tonight, because today is a very big day in the Oneonta music department world. Number one, besides being Taco Tuesday, which is always a good day to have, right? Every Tuesday is Taco Tuesday in my book. There is, at 5 o'clock, there is a concert as part of the Alden Room series, and I believe you played one of these, correct?
I think I was the inaugural concert last October.
Yes, which is super cool. So with that, that's in the library?
Yeah, it's in the Alden Room where they house their special archives. It's a quiet space up on the third floor. Definitely worth visiting.
Cool. So we are looking forward to that. That's going to be Rob Roman tonight with Rich Mullen on bass, Rob Lapari on drums, And that starts at 5, and I believe it goes 5 to 6. And then at 6 p.m. in M201, there is a student capstone. David Rollin is going to be doing his capstone at 6 p.m. And then at 8 p.m. is going to be Magnus Chanel. He's also doing a senior recital, not a capstone per se, tonight, which is going to feature a bunch of pretty cool things. Some piano works. I listened to him play some Bach, actually, which is pretty cool. And then his band, The Witch, and he's going to also be doing some kind of digital music project called Overcorrect, I believe, is also going to be on this recital. So we are looking forward to that. But when I was picking up music this morning for Dr. Kent, and it seems like you have more... do you hear that echo when you're talking?
Very much.
That's totally wild. I'm gonna try a different mic when we come back and just see if that switches it or not. I don't know if it will or not, but there's something super fun going on with a slapback echo here. Maybe it's just because you're so amazing. You were hearing your voice come from all angles.
It must be my ghost.
That's right, the ghost of Adam Kent. When I was trying to pick out music, I was trying to pick up music for the guests if they don't bring any in. And I was thinking of trying to pick out something in a classical, I don't want to say classical, but traditional sense, I guess I would say, that had to do with piano and guitar, which I did. And then also something, I know you're a fan of the Spanish world in terms of music and performers and so forth. So what I did was I picked out a Bach piece, a J.S. Bach piece that was written for something called the Lauten work, I believe it was called. It was like a harpsichord lute. So basically it had like lute strings on it, but you played it like a piano. And I believe this piece was originally written for that. It's so hard to tell with the Bach stuff. And then it was transcribed later on for multiple lute. It was originally in E flat. I don't know the player who's going to play it, which I'll talk about in a second. I know when you play it on guitar, most people drop the low D string down and play it in what's called drop D tuning. So they move it down a half step because, as we all know, the guitar does not like to play in flat keys. It likes to play in sharp keys. And this was also just a tradition, I guess, of back going whatever, like, didn't matter what key it was in, you just transposed it to whatever made sense. All the lute transcript, the cello transcriptions are in different keys too. And a lot of times Bach would actually transcribe these things for other instruments and put them in other keys.
Yeah.
It was pretty frequent for him to do that. So, but once again, it's hard to tell if he did it or one of his kids did it or somebody else. You know, back in those days, the cataloging system wasn't exactly great. So, the performance of this, by the way, this is BWV 998 called the Prelude Fugue and Allegro, which is one of my favorite pieces by the great Bach, is done by Narciso Yepes, who's an amazing Spanish guitarist or was a virtuoso in his own accord and just a great player. I actually really like his recordings of Vivaldi, the Vivaldi concerto stuff as well. But I actually do, Deutsche Grammophon released a great, he recorded all of the Bach lute works for Deutsche Grammophon years ago and released that. And we're going to be listening to the first movement here, then we're going to talk a little bit about it, and then the story of Dr. Adam Kent. Are you ready?
Ready to go.
Okay, let's listen to the Prelude Fugue and Allegro. Here's just the prelude first.
Thank you.
Can I hear you? Can you talk into the mic? Let's see if your mic's going.
Yeah, how we doing?
That's way better.
All right.
We'll look at there's no reverb going on. Okay, we fixed the mic problem. Okay, so that was that a D or was that an E flat, you know?
To me, it sounded a little more flattish.
Okay, you know? so I think it is an E flat.
So the tuning systems were a little bit different back then. Or maybe just the way that was recorded or played back.
So he also plays on like an 8 to a 10 string guitar, so he can tune to whatever he wants to. Most people these days wouldn't do that. They would just kind of play on a 6 string.
Yeah.
And do whatever, but he was like an aficionado with that kind of thing where they could have, it was kind of like a lute where you threw in these extra strings. This was a big thing in the guitar world for quite a bit during his time.
Yeah, I wonder if he didn't do it to try to emulate the power of flamenco guitar and in those tremolos and everything.
Oh, I'm sure.
But I remember reading he had these double strung guitars he used. But it's wonderful to wake up and hear Bach, and to be reminded, you know, we talk about classical music as this, some people think, very rigid form of music that's notated, and like the notation police are going to come and get you if you deviate from what's on the printed page, or if you start a trill on the wrong note,
sure,
or if the edition you play from has a slur that isn't in the original decrepit manuscript. And it's good to be reminded that, first of all, these preludes were improvisations in themselves. What is Bach doing in this prelude and in the preludes of his well-tempered clavier and so on? He's showing us how he improvised, what improvisation sounded like. You take basic chords and you noodle around them. They were warm-up pieces. And, you know, from everything we know about Baroque performance practice, it wasn't about things being fixed. But like you said before, it's like, why don't we transcribe it to this key because that'll work better on this instrument. There are keyboard concertos, let's say, in one key. Like there's a keyboard concerto in D major by Bach that's exactly the same as a violin concerto in E major. He thought nothing of it. So music was meant to be adapted. And I think it's now that we look back and call this music classical and like it's sacrosanct and we can't touch it and we can't invest anything of ourselves into it. And I think it's a misconception.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, my big take on the whole thing is I'm always interested when a modern player of our generation or whatever, like, plays something an older repertoire, and it's totally wild, and they do something totally different with it. And I'm always, like, very much into it. I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool, like, your take on it. I remember there was Dennis Turchek, who was my teacher. I forgot what piece it was. It was I don't think it was Villa-Lobos, but it was somebody of that time and in era. There was a section of a song I did not like. I didn't like it. I went to play it, and I left out like 10 bars. And he goes, "Where's those? You just skipped the whole thing, and I don't like it." He goes, "Well, you can't just skip it." I go, "Why not?" And then we had this, you know, fundamental argumentation about whether or not I had to play it or not had to play it. And I said, I learned it, you know, and I, to due respect to the composer, I learned it and I played it for him. And then I said, but I'm not playing it live because I don't like it. And I just didn't. I just skipped it and found a way to go from this section to the next section with these 10 bars missing. And he found it to be so crazy to me at the time. But then later on, he said, I understand what you were doing there. You know, it didn't make you happy. And I said, it didn't.
Yeah. There's stories of Rachmaninoff, great composer, pianist of the first half of the 20th century. He had a set of variations on a theme by Chopin. I think it was about 20 variations. And he kept a journal about performing the piece on tour. And he said, I've never gotten through all 20 variations in any city. I gauge it by the coughing I hear from the audience. So it's like the most I ever got through was maybe 17 in New York and Chicago. I think I only played 10 of them.
That's amazing.
And there's, I'm thinking back to Chopin's time, 19th century. He had a pupil. I think it was a Scottish woman named Jane Stirling, who was not a very accomplished virtuoso. And she was playing one of his etudes. There was a difficult passage she just could not handle. And Chopin just X'd it out off the score and said, now you don't play it. It just goes from here to here. And, you know, you got it from the horse's mouth. Chopin authorized that.
So, yeah. No, it's an interesting take on that. I try to call it, I don't know, it's tradition. I use the word traditional music, and I don't know if that's a good term. I don't know what the term is. I guess it would be like written music is almost is a better way to put it as opposed to learning, you know.
Yeah, I have a take on it. I see this more as... I see it as classical musicians being the actors of the music world. We get a script, but we ultimately have to inhabit the character, right? Yes. And that's why you can go on Broadway and you can see a really successful show and the cast changes and people want to go and see it again. And they'll be like, yeah, even though the new lead is saying the same words, it's a totally different character because they understand it in a totally different way. They still can invest something of themselves, even though they start with a script. I mean, for me, the printed music is actually something freeing. And I think that might surprise many of our students who see it as a, you know...
A blockade to
spontaneity. I think the alternative for many musicians is... I copy recordings. I learn by tradition. I copy my teacher. And I wind up being sort of a second-rate version of the thing I keep listening to on YouTube. I think score, there it is. That's my pipeline to the music, to the composer.
You do what you want to do without the influence of somebody else.
Yeah. You just have to go through that period of drudgery of learning it and learning how to read music.
But. That is true. Which is not that hard. And some people really, they fight it, you know. You know, they fight the reading part. And I always tell people written music is meant to not be looked at in the end.
Right.
Like that's the whole point. Like, you look at it so it's preserved so you can look at it. And it's gorgeous to look at as well. But the point is to get off book.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the conductor, Michael Tilson Thomas, saying, look, Beethoven didn't wake up one morning and say, I think I'll write an eighth rest followed by 3/8 notes and a half note with a fermata on it. He woke up one morning and he was like, ba-ba-ba-bum. And then he's like, okay, how do I write that down?
Yes.
You know.
Correct. It's the same with, for me, it's the same with, I'm an avid reader of novels. So it's the same with reading for me. Like, I'll read something and I'll talk about it with somebody else and they'll get this completely different other's perspective of it, you know, from the author's mouth. But it's the same thing with music. Like, oh, I hear it as this or you hear it as that and so forth. So. But with all that being said, what we're interested in is you.
Oh, no.
We are interested. You are Superman, as far as I'm concerned, Dr. Adam Kent. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about upbringing. And then until you brought your presence here to SUNY Oneonta, because this is a big time, which I don't know much about, and maybe a lot of our guests don't know about, I'm assuming they don't. So let's talk about up to college first.
Yeah, I was raised in a suburb of New York City, New Rochelle, New York.
Oh, yes.
It's featured in a song, 45 Minutes from Broadway. If you know the Broadway musical Ragtime, it's based on a novel that takes place around the corner from where I grew up. I wanted to play the piano from the time I was a very young kid. My grandmother gave us a piano she had in her house when I was about 5. And I started to teach myself. And then I got some group lessons at my elementary school and then started taking private piano lessons. I was about 10 when I started going to Manhattan School of Music, pre-college division. And I had a kind of crazy, intense, possessive teacher from Cuba.
Okay.
And that person remained my teacher right through my college years and through the master's degree I got at Manhattan School of Music.
Amazing.
And, it was, you know, one of those intense relationships that probably went on for too long. And that was, you know, very possessive and controlling as teacher-student relationships can get. And by the time I got my master's, I was sick of teachers. I was sick of being a student. I wanted to be on my own. And I was on my own for about 7 or 8 years. I felt I was learning a lot. I was entering competitions. I had some successes. I was doing some concerts. And I figured this is just how things could continue. And then, you know, I realized I was approaching 30. age 30, which is old in the classical music world. And there's a lot of truisms out there like, well, you know, if you're not a star playing all over the world by the time you're 30, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And I decided I wanted to go back to school and get a doctorate. And I went to Juilliard.
So you got your undergrad. Can I just backtrack just a second before we'll come right back to that? Undergrad?
Was Manhattan School of Music.
And so was the...
Was the master's.
And both of those were in... What
piano performance.
Piano performance. Both those degrees were piano performance.
Yeah.
Well, did you apply to any other schools besides Manhattan?
You know, I'm not proud of this. I have literally applied to two schools in my academic life. One was Manhattan School of Music. The other was Juilliard. And I got into both. To this day, my parents berate me for not having shopped around. But
I mean, those are great schools,
but,
you know.
But nevertheless, in the case of Manhattan School of Music, I was really under the spell of this Bengali teacher.
And you were already there, like working.
I was already there since I was a kid in their junior program.
That makes sense.
So that kind of felt comfortable. Juilliard, though, I didn't really go there. People always think you go and you get a doctorate because you want an academic life. I really wanted the stimulation. I wanted to be surrounded by other talented people who'd kick my butt a little bit. Sure. I wanted to form ensembles, which I did. I founded a trio that lasted for a long time and made a lot of recordings.
Was that cello, violin?
Cello, violin, and piano. We called ourselves the Damocles Trio, like Sword of Damocles.
Yeah, the Sword of Damocles hanging over my head.
You know, we decided we were all getting a doctorate of musical arts degree, a DMA. So we wanted the letters DMA in our name. So we didn't want to be the really Dam funny. Trio. So we did Damocles. And then, of course, we had to explain to people that they shouldn't feel personally threatened by it. But that it was more like we made music as if the Sword of Damocles were hanging over our heads. Like, sure. It's a symbol of the preciousness of life and how you have to make every moment count. So, and the person I worked with at Juilliard was this amazing Renaissance man, Jerome Lowenthal, who's still alive and playing actively in his 90s.
Your teacher there?
He was my teacher there.
Okay.
And he was so much of an antidote to the Cuban control freak I had worked with when I was younger.
That's a great song title, The Cuban Control Freak.
I didn't realize it was alliterative, but Jerry Lowenthal was the kind of guy you would ask him a technical question about pedaling, and 30 minutes later he'd be quoting Baudelaire's poetry.
Awesome.
And finally, like, work it around to why you shouldn't change the pedal except on bass notes in Debussy. But he's an astonishing guy, and he had a very liberating effect on the way I thought about music and what my goals were playing the piano. So I'm grateful for that experience.
That's a dissertation. Was that a performance dissertation or?
They kind of got you every which way. You had to do a series of recitals and lecture recitals, and you had to write a dissertation.
Okay.
So I got to research and write my paper on the kind of music that I was particularly interested in, which was, broadly speaking, it was the music of Spain. I mean, the dissertation focused on the part of Spain in the northeast where Barcelona is. It's called Catalunya. Okay. And in Catalunya, they don't speak Castilian Spanish. They speak Catalan, which is a different Romance language. And they have a very distinctive history, very distinctive culture. And I was interested in the folk music of Catalonia and how certain composers had incorporated it into their music. It was a successful dissertation. It won a prize at graduation for the best dissertation.
Amazing.
That music remains very much a part of my repertoire. I mean, I got into it in a totally fortuitous way. I initially had no interest in Spanish music. People have often asked me that I must have some Spanish genetics. Otherwise, why would I be interested in it? And I remember doing Ancestry DNA a few years ago thinking, maybe I'll discover I'm like a Sephardic Jew or something, a descendant of the Jewish people who were expelled from Spain in 1492. But no, just 100% Ashkenazi, Eastern European Jewish. But I can trace the moment when I discovered Spanish music. I was 11 years old. My grandparents took me to hear this pianist named Alicia de la Rocha at Lincoln Center, who was supposed to be a very famous pianist of the day. And first half, she was playing like music by Bach and Haydn and Mendelssohn, this kind of stuff I was familiar with. Second half looked like she was playing music by someone named Falla, F-A-L-L-A.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
And I assume that's how you pronounce it. And I wasn't really curious about that. And we, in fact, missed the whole first half because we got stuck in traffic. And so there I was stuck hearing this unfamiliar music. And I fell in love with it within like 30 seconds. This just hooked me. And I, you know, have been a passionate Hispanophile ever since then. I was a huge fan of Alicia de la Rocha's. I used to go to her concerts in New York with big banners that I would like raise at the end, like Viva Alicia.
Like number one fan.
Te queremos, Alicia. And, you know, to this day, I have a friendship with her daughter who, you know, continues to live in what had been her mother's apartment in Barcelona, which she's converted into this amazing archive with all of her mother's scores.
Does her daughter play too?
The daughter does know how to play, actually plays more jazz, but it's not one of these family dynasties.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, Alicia's, of an older generation, Alicia's mother and aunt had studied with Enrique Granados,
the composer. Yeah.
So she felt that very direct connection.
Wow. It's so amazing hearing those. I had Dr. Nepke on here, too, and it was, like, crazy hearing, like, the same things. Like these people that I, these composers and conductors and, you know, giants of the music world that are, like, one or two steps off from the faculty here. Like, I don't know, one or two steps, but connection, you know what I mean? It's like the degrees of Kevin Bacon or something like that. But, I was, myself and Matt Downey, who's the classical guitar teacher here, we're like third gen Segovia.
Yeah.
Which is so interesting that we just studied with, you know, people, somebody who studied, you know, and it's a small world in that aspect. And just interesting to see the connections. And so much of it spawns from New York City.
Yeah.
You know, like this, people go through New York City with a lot of this stuff, you know.
I mean, it's interesting to think how we reflect or transmit what we were taught, and I think it's usually not black and white. Like one idea is like each of us from generation to generation passes down what we received, but there's plenty of rebellion too, right?
Oh, a lot of it.
And a lot of it is like, I'm going to do everything as a teacher my teacher didn't do, and vice versa. So I think it's, you kind of have to look critically at what people mean when they say they're descendants. Because there are people out there saying they're descendants of Franz Liszt, because they can trace Franz Liszt taught this person who taught this person, and eventually you get to me.
Sure. Like, yeah, it's interesting. Although, like I said, Dennis was my teacher. The first week in there, I was like, I'm not growing my fingernails, like, out on my right hand, which classical guitar players at that point were doing.
Right.
And I was like, I can't. I play bass and piano and all these other things. And it was like the argument of all arguments for like years, you know. It was like, I'm not doing it, you know, I'm going back to the Fernando Sore days where he didn't use nails sore, you know. So I was
that's why he was sore.
That's right, that's why he was sore. That's a good joke. So yeah, anyways, it yeah, we all change our kind of things, and we all have beef with our teachers and so forth, and that's a good thing, right? It's a great thing to be, no, I'm gonna do this because I'm gonna do this.
Yeah, like, do we think our students represent us?
Oh, I hope not.
Yeah.
No, at least for me. So before I play the fugue from this Bach piece, what I do want to say is, are there any pieces that you played during your doctoral, you know, presentations that you still play to this day live?
Yes. I mean, I learned a ton of music by a Catalan composer named Federico Mompó. And that's probably, when people ask me if I have a favorite composer, of course I say no, because I love all kinds of music. But in terms of a composer that feels most comfortable to me, emotionally, pianistically, Mompó touches something very deep inside of me. And it's
how do you spell that?
Mompou.
Okay.
He, by the way, has one important original guitar composition. I think he dedicated to Segovia, the Suite Compostelana.
Interesting. I don't know this, so I'll have to look this up.
He has that, but it's mostly his small little piano pieces that's what he's known for. They're not virtuosic. They're not
mid 1900s.
Yeah, born 1893, dies in 78. So, yeah, okay, middle of the century.
Okay.
Music, he grew up in a family that ran a bell foundry, you know, that would cast and repair bells. So he was fascinated by bell sounds and capturing them in his music. And so that's certainly a big part of my repertoire still. On the other hand, once in a while, I look at old programs and I'm like, shit. Oh,
is that on the list?
It's like, I'm like, I used to play.
Naughty.
I was just thinking, like, we went to hear Tristan and Isolde at the Met the other week, a fabulous production. And I'm like, wait a minute, I used to play a transcription of the Liebestod. It's like, I wouldn't even know where to begin that. But I did that when I was getting my doctorate and I played.
Oh.
So some of the stuff I haven't touched since then. And, you know, I don't know if you find it this way. I find there's music I learned when I was very young that still lodged in my fingers. I could play it at 3 in the morning. Then there's the stuff I learned when I was an adult, let's say in the doctoral program. If I don't keep playing it, it just slips away.
Oh, yeah. There are pieces I was watching some classical guitarist the other day just playing some Giuliani and stuff like that. I was like, oh, I used to play that piece. I couldn't play any of it.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't remember any of this. It's just so funny just because it didn't hit me the way certain things do hit me. But, okay, speaking of that, this piece, which I still can't play, but I have played before. I never played it live, but which is one of the hardest things that I find to play on the instrument in terms of just playing Bach is hard in general.
Yes.
And I always just use it not as a live performance thing, but just to hold myself into check. And that's why I keep Bach around in my entire life. I'm like, if you want to humble yourself, whenever a student's like, I'm really good, I would just throw out some Bach in front of him. I was like, how good are you? Go ahead. So even playing a fugue on the guitar is like another thing that's like crazy, right? The four-voice fugue or something like that is nuts. So we're going to listen to the fugue part of this Prelude, Fugue, and Allegro, which I think is absolutely wonderful. And then we're going to come back and talk about post-years of after Juilliard, and then your big concert coming up next Monday. I guess I would call it a big concert, right? It's a big concert, right?
Every concert feels big.
That's right. Every concert's the same. It's amazing, right? It's something we get to do. So, okay, here's the fugue from Prelude, Fugue, and Allegro, BWV 998 by Bach, played by Yuppies. All right, so there's the fugue, which is totally amazing. And what I was just saying, it doesn't take much liberty with the timing or tempo. Just kind of straight going in, going for it.
But, you know, I always tell my students in music history and music appreciation courses about Bach and his fugues, it kind of represents the pinnacle of the two ways we think of music in the West. It's sort of the horizontal and the vertical, right? So the horizontal part of music is the linear, the melodic, what you can do with a musical line. And, of course, the vertical is harmony, how they come together.
Yep.
And I think in the Bach fugues, there's a kind of independence and separate life to those two components because you have the lines of the fugue, the various statements of the subject that have their own lives and begin and end and overlap as they do. And then you still, everything works together harmoniously. And so you can find in a Bach fugue, oh, this is like a cadence, but it's not just a stopping point because just as the cadence started, a new entrance of the fugue subject came in. So
exactly.
So it's both things. It seems to keep those two aspects of music in equanimity better than any other composer, which makes it very hard to memorize, very hard to get into your fingers. He's not thinking melody and accompaniment. He's making your brain work on.
My brain hurts.
My brain hurts. and
you know, in a good way.
I think it was, there's a now deceased pianist scholar named Charles Rosen, who I once heard say, Bach fugues, Bach's keyboard music, is music really written to be enjoyed more than anything by the performer because there's stuff going on that's so complex that really only the performer is going to get it. Like, I don't know about this fugue, but in some fugues, you've got wild stuff like retrogrades. Like, he's playing the main subject backwards. Now, that's a really, really cool idea. The average listener might
not
hear
that.
They're
not going to catch it. Yeah.
But you, who've studied the piece, you get to experience.
Correct.
And if you think about the keyboard instruments of the time, like the harpsichord, they were not touch sensitive the way the piano was. So when we play Bach fugues on the piano, we can highlight the voices and the entrances.
Yeah,
of the
you can't do that with the harpsichord.
So surely a lot of this had to just be appreciated by the player who knew it was there but who couldn't thump out one voice above another voice.
That's correct. I mean, there was a pianoforte near the end of his
He apparently got to try some pianos when he visited his son at the court of Friedrich the Great in 1747.
Okay.
And so it's possible that one of the fugues from the musical offering really was conceived with the pianoforte in mind.
Interesting.
But most of his keyboard music would have predated that.
Sure. You did have the organ, so you could put some stops on there to make sure that certain voices came out and so forth. But when you're playing a harpsichord, it's a completely different thing.
Well, you know what you do get on the harpsichord, and this is a big part of Baroque music, you have ornamentation. And I think one of the reasons there's all these fancy little itty-bitty ornaments in Baroque keyboard music is as a substitute for touch sensitivity, right?
Sure.
You can't have a subtle dynamic nuance on a harpsichord, so you put in a little mordant. You put in a little expressive.
The mordant.
As a
I love that word. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about your teaching career and then education career. And then I want to make sure at 8:50 or so we hit the concert. So a quick 6-minute synopsis of your teaching career.
Let's see. I guess I was lucky that my overbearing, controlling Cuban teacher invited me to be his assistant at Manhattan School of Music when I was very young. I was about 19. So I myself was an undergraduate.
Yep.
And I started to assist him with students in the pre-college. So I remain on the faculty of Manhattan School of Music pre-college to this day.
Yep.
And that has given me access to a very high level of serious music students. Over the years, I also had students privately. I taught here and there at community music schools. I taught as an adjunct at Brooklyn College, New Jersey City University, and so on. And honestly, that was going to be my life. That and playing concerts and just somehow cobbling together a living with a home base in New York City. And then I got old. And
oh, you're not old.
You know, like approaching 50. And I'm like, I don't think I can make this work forever. This is just the incertitude is really getting to me. These yeah. cycles of, oh, all my students graduated. What am I going to do? Or, oh, I don't have any concerts for the next 6 months. So I decided to look for a full-time teaching position. And wouldn't you know it, there was one here. And I had some passing familiarity with Oneonta because a very close friend of my partner's owns a home in a tiny little hole in the wall nearby. I think it's called Rose Boom or Rose Bloom. I have
Bloomville?
To.
Bloomville? No, Rose.
It could be Bloomville.
Okay.
It could be Bloomville. Maybe Delhi is probably the nearest city.
Yeah, so I think it probably is Bloomville.
Right. I'll
somewhere around there.
And I think owned some property here in Oneonta.
Okay.
So we visited. We also, you know, would go up to Cooperstown, which of course is gorgeous.
Yep.
So I had that familiarity. And I applied for the job. It was late in the game. I learned later on some of the backstory about why it was so late, but actually wound up coming up here to candidate in June after all the students were gone. So they had to sort of like have actors play the role of Oneonta students for me to sample teach.
Yeah, what year was this? 16.
So it was
okay.
10 years ago.
So you've been here for 10 years?
I've been here for 10 years.
You got your 10-year chip this year? Did you get invited to the dinner or is that next year?
I don't know. No. I think if I have some free food coming, I definitely am not going
to. You get invited to this little ceremony where they give you, I had my 25th a couple of years ago, and you get a gift certificate to the store on campus for the amount of years that you've been here. So you'll get a $10 gift certificate to the.
Okay.
That's what you get this year.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, that's fine. When they asked me, they said when I had my 25th year, they said, oh, what are you looking forward to most? And I said, I'm looking forward to the $50 gift certificate when I've been here for 50 years.
Man.
Thank you so much. I could buy a sweatshirt. Anyways, but no, I love this school and it's awesome. It's a very nice ceremony. So I think they give them out at 5, 10, 15, 20, like 5-year increments.
I mean, I will say one of the things that impressed me the most when I got here and continues to impress me is just the natural beauty of the area. I mean, I would be driving down Ravine Parkway, and I would see a family of deer out on the lawn. And I would slam on my brake and start, you know, clicking pictures. And, you know, I'd create a traffic jam and people honking at me.
You're like, the deer.
I was like, I can't believe it, you know, because for me growing up, seeing a deer was like an apparition.
Yeah, right.
It never happened. And now, of course, they're like squirrels in New York City.
Yeah, they're all over the place. And then, they're in my backyard, you know. They're walking down my street.
Oh, yeah.
They walk down the sidewalk. It's very fun.
They're like tame, like dogs. And but just the natural beauty still I find kind of overwhelming. And the students are amazing. The students are so diverse in their tastes. And in many ways, I like the fact that they don't come to their studies here with a lot of background or baggage in classical music or anything else like that. They're kind of, they don't think categorically. They know they know what they like. And so, you know, there might be a kid, let's say, who's into heavy metal, and he'll overhear me practicing some Rachmaninoff as he walks into the class and be like, oh, what's the name of that song? And they'll write it down and they'll find it on Spotify, add it to their playlist. And it's just one more song that lives side by side with everything else. And I think that's more the way people are taking in music in modern times, right? I mean, the world of the record store, the radio station, these are all more and more of the past for our students.
Correct.
They're just able to self-program whatever strikes their fancy. And I think it gives someone like me an in to throw in some stuff.
And we're glad to have you here. That's awesome. I love teaching at this school, and SUNY NME's department's awesome. It, along with the students, is such an eclectic group of faculty members, which are all characters on their own accord.
Yeah.
And I absolutely, every time I go to work in the morning, I'm like, all these people are awesome. Like, music departments are generally fun places to work. They can be. If it's a very heavy performance thing, I also went to Potsdam before, and that was not as fun. Mm-hmm. But this department is super fun. And also encouraging students to do what they wish to do with the guidance of the professors. So,
absolutely.
With that being said, it's perfect timing, 8:50. What I want to do is you have a concert that you're going to be putting on Monday, next Monday, correct? May the 4th be with you, which is my favorite holiday of the year. Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about what's going to be happening, where it is, who the performers are, XYZ?
Well, it's a concert that was really organized by our new colleague here on campus, Dr. Janai LaVita, who is a professor of voice. She's someone I had some acquaintance with previously because she taught at Manhattan School of Music.
Yep.
She is married to a very gifted guitarist who's playing, you might look forward to hearing, yes. Giacomo. And so I know part of the program is her doing duets with Giacomo. And then she and I are going to do an eclectic set of pieces. There's a song by a composer named Lori Laitman, who it turns out is a graduate of New Rochelle High School, where I went. And it's a beautiful song that in its poetry references the town of Oneonta and a summer that she spent here going to music camp. She's got another song.
She must have gone to the Hartwick Music Camp, I bet.
It must have been Hartwick, yeah.
Which was all. I worked for that camp for a couple of years. It was a great camp.
Before it came over here, yeah.
Yeah.
And she's got another song by a composer named Leslie Adams, The Heart of a Woman. It's in a kind of African-American pop idiom. We've got some Spanish music, a set of songs by Joaquin Turina, Spanish composer from Seville. Yeah. And then she's got some fun stuff, a song about a green dragon who devours everything and everyone in sight until he meets his match in the daughter of the king. I won't say anything more, but it's a fun song to scare your kids with. And then I think, again, I have to check on this list, but I think Janai's going to like pop her tits off too. She's doing an aria from Les Mamelles de Tiresias, the Tits of Tiresias by Poulenc, Francis Poulenc, the opera. And so it's a wild piece where the character Thérèse sort of renounces all of the shackles of, you know, femininity in a male-dominated culture and winds up by freeing her breasts. And it's a fun, zany song. So I imagine she'll do that at the end because there won't be much left for her after.
Very cool. Yeah, very cool.
So there's a plug. I mean, you get to see sex. You get to be terrify your kids. Yeah.
So this is going to take – so this is Monday, May the 4th.
Yes, and I should know if – I think it's at 5:30.
Okay.
In M201.
In M201. If you go to any of the social media, the music department social media sites on Instagram, you can find it. Also, probably online if you go to the music department website at studioniana.com or .org.
Yeah, people keep talking about it as our Star Wars concert.
That's right.
It takes me a moment to...
Yes, you can find out when the times of that are. Also, I'll announce it. I'll find out the exact details, and I'll announce that on Friday as well and Monday morning just so that we have the exact things. Okay, so with that being said, I'm going to put on the last movement of this Bach piece, Allegro, and then we'll have our after this is done, we'll have our closing remarks, and then the most important question will get asked by me before we tune out for the day. So just be prepared. That's a good question. Okay. Here's the Allegro from Prelude, Fugue, and Allegro. It's a zipper, this one. And I don't remember how fast Yepes plays it, but it generally goes relatively quick. Here we go. Thank you. We're talking about fugues here. What were you saying about the fugues?
I was just saying there's like a handful of fugues from like the Well-Tempered Clavier where he's got not one idea, but let's say three ideas. Like they call them a subject, counter-subject.
Yeah.
And the whole piece, it's like a juggler. He's showing you, oh, I can put this one on top, this one in the middle, this one on the bottom. And, oh, in my next section, I'm going to flip it this way and that way. And that's what the piece is. It's like just showing you all the ways and all of the ways he can layer three different ideas.
Insanity.
It's insanity.
Yeah, he's such a... Do you compose at all? Have you composed anything?
When I was a kid, that's what I wanted to do.
Okay.
And when I discovered Spanish music, I wanted to write music in that style. But anyway, to make a long story short, by the time I was an adolescent, I realized I was more interested in bringing other people's great music to life as a performer.
Yep.
But someday, if I live long enough and am healthy and retire, I'd love to go back and compose.
It's a totally different. I mean, I'm mainly these days. It was when I was younger. I always composed stuff, music, but I was also a player for a while. And then, in I'd say my late 20s or so, I just turned into the writing songs instead, which is what I focus on now, which I enjoy. Yeah, it is. Everybody has their own way in the musical world, and all of them are very highly respected by me. So, okay, here's the last question. You ready?
Oh.
If you're going to go out and eat tonight, right, in Oneana, where are you going to go? If it was open, right? That's the most important question. What's your favorite restaurant in town?
Oh, B-Side.
Oh, right?
Yeah, B-Side. I mean, I understand the co-ownership of B-Side and Autumn.
And the Autumn.
And I love them both. I love the micro-brewed beers here. My happiest spot in the area, which now is under new management, was Red Shed Brewery outside of Cooperstown.
Oh, yes. Now it's a Northway.
It's something else, but I just feel like some of the happiest, most serene times in my life have been sitting out there in the summer.
Sure.
On that lawn, there's just – that's feng shui.
Yeah, yeah. We played there a ton. You know, I think we're playing there again sometime in June or something. But, yeah, it's a cool – there's so many microbreweries around here. This is how I spend my summers with my band because those are great gigs because they're mid-afternoon.
Yeah, I don't even have to work. I just go and drink. I can listen to you.
Yeah, that's right. Awesome. Well, we want to thank Dr. Adam Kent – for coming on this morning, and I will have more information once again on the May 4th show, exact times, and we know the location, which is M201. So we believe it's 5:30, but we'll look and make sure that we're doubled on that. So if anybody's around today, 5 p.m., go to the Alden Room in the library to hear Robert Roman in his jazz trio, and he's an incredible player. I tell you, Roman, who was the department chair for a long time, didn't play as much when he was chair, because when you're chair, you don't have as much time. But since he's not been chair, I've been listening. He's right down the hall from me practicing all the time. And I heard him yesterday, and he sounds so good. Mm. So good. And, of course, Rob Lapari and Rich Mullen kill it. So that's at 5 o'clock. David Rollin, 6 p.m., M201, Capstone, 8 p.m. today. Magnus Chanel, which we all know is the operations manager here at Wony as well. He'll be on at 8 p.m. tonight as M201. Rock and roll. It's DJ Nosh from Mark 2 coming in live. What's in your pocket? Basement of Hunt Union, home of Red Dragon Radio. Keeping it locked. Stay tuned on Friday where Gavin Vitelli comes in and tries to convince me that Kiss is a good band. That's it for me. I'll see everybody on Friday. Rock and roll over.
Visit snapedny.org. Save time, save money, eat healthy.
SNAP-Ed is funded by USDA Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. This institution is an equal opportunity provider.
Hey, everyone. You're listening to the Wony Weekly Update. Here are some upcoming events to look forward to.